This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. You're listening to The Lines Between Us, our series about inequality in our region. When someone commits a crime, it's generally accepted that person should pay their debt to society, meaning spend time in prison, perhaps, and compensate those whom they've harmed. But does paying a debt to society mean someone should end up in financial debt? Today, we examine the costs incurred by people who are dealing with the criminal justice system from the moment of arrest to the years following release, how those debts can pile up and create financial scars that can last longer than the time behind bars. With me to speak about this is Natalie Finniger, the Deputy District Public Defender for Baltimore City. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, to hear from people who know firsthand about the costs of dealing with the criminal justice system, our producer Stephanie Hughes visited Baltimore's Center for Urban Families. She talked with Jesse Johnson, who's 28 years old, about the price of being represented by counsel.
Getting a public defender, they say it's like, I think the fee right now is like $50. But when you in and out of court and in and out of court and you really don't have a means of income, it just piles up on you, you know, and you end up owing $300-$400 in court costs.
Natalie, I thought public defenders were free. Tell me about this charge.
Well, we are required by statute to charge $50 in order to open up a file. So the way it is phrased is that our representation is free, but there is an administrative fee that's imposed upon our clients in order to complete the paperwork for their application. And although we can waive it, we can only waive it in very limited circumstances by law. So it's something that we're forced to do. And many of us would like to see it go away and think that it kind of gets in the way sometimes of us being able to adequately intake our clients and the kind of stress that they face in order to be thinking about, now I've got a criminal case and I owe $50 and I have to go to court.
Does that fee as collected in the aggregate actually represent a significant part of the budget of the public defender's office?
The money doesn't actually go to the public defender's office. It goes to the general state fund. And so it doesn't represent any portion of our budget. And the collection rate, I don't think, is very high. I don't have those figures in front of me, though.
When Jesse Johnson talks about you end up owing $300-$400, and you said there's a $50 fee to start the case, is he talking about other fees, too? He mentions court costs.
Yeah. So court costs are something that has been on the increase. Recently, they have been raised. And so now, for you to appear in the District Court of Maryland, between the court costs and what they call a criminal injuries compensation fund fee, that's a fund that's set up to compensate victims. It's a $57.50 charge. And that's in addition to any fines that the judge may impose. And in the circuit court, it's $165. And that is just for one court appearance. Those fees can actually go up if subpoenas are served by the sheriff or there are multiple court appearances. And it used to be that judges had the freedom to waive it if they were looking at an individual who was indigent, that their income in the future was probably likely to be limited, say they had severe mental, physical, or emotional difficulties. But now judges have to make a determination that somebody's going to be indigent for the next 12 years. And that, of course, is an argument that's difficult to make, and it's difficult for a determination for a judge to make. So many times now our clients are faced with those fees in order to pay them. They have to pay them within a certain time period that the judge grants. And so as a public defender, we are frequently trying to paint out a realistic situation for our clients. But if they're not paid by the due date and the judge doesn't grant an extension, then a warrant can issue for an individual's arrest and they can be incarcerated for what's called a deferred payment and not paying those court costs on time.
There's also the cost of bail. Do bails vary depending on what jurisdiction in Maryland you're in?
Bails do vary a great deal depending upon the jurisdiction. And here in Baltimore City, our bails are extremely high. There's been a recent study by the Justice Policy Institute pointing out that Baltimore's bails are much higher than the national average, much higher than the rest of Maryland. And bails can vary a great deal. The initial bail determination is made by a court commissioner. That's within 24 hours after the arrest of the individual. And there is no objective risk assessment tool or kind of processing of information. So it's left up to the individual court commissioner to take a look at a case, take a look at an individual's background, and set an initial bail. Clients would have to post all that bail if they're going to receive any refund after the case is over with. But more likely than not, our indigent clients, the poor folks that I represent, are going to be using a bail bondsman. And so they're going to be paying 10% of that bail, which they will never receive back. So if a court commissioner sets $25,000 bail, then a family member is going to have to come up with $2,500 to pay through a bail bondsman, or they would have to come up with $25,000, even if it is just temporarily, to post for that individual to be released from jail. Bails can be revisited by a judge the next district court session, but oftentimes once that initial determination is made, it's a hard road to argue that it should be reduced or that somebody should be released on their own recognizance.
Why are bails higher in Baltimore? Is there some kind of market economy at work, or what's the difference in Baltimore compared to someplace else in the state?
You know, it's a very interesting question, and I think you just establish a culture. And so we have a culture of high bails, and judges will give reasons for worrying that somebody's going to flee or that they're going to pose a danger to the community. But if we look across the border to Washington, D.C., another metropolitan area that I think we could also say, you know, suffers from higher crime rates than anybody would like, they have actually been able to release a much higher percentage of folks there. And they use it using pretrial services that have a extended supervision of individuals. So there, they're concentrating on incarcerating individuals that are charged with very serious offenses and very violent offenses. And more than likely, everybody else is going to be released under supervision into the community without a bail being posted, so without money being exchanged in order for their release. And they may be ordered into some treatment programs or monitored heavily, depending upon the circumstances. Interestingly enough, they have a higher rate of showing up for court than we do here in Baltimore. So we have to kind of ask ourselves, why is it that we set bail the way we do, and what are we getting out of it?
On WIPR, this is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Natalie Finniger, Deputy District Public Defender for Baltimore City. We're talking about the criminal justice system and debt. Let's talk about what happens once a person is behind bars in jail or in prison. How can they take care of personal finances like rent or mortgage, credit cards?
It's virtually impossible for our clients to take care of those personal financial matters. If you think about how most of us interact financially these days, we're doing it online, occasionally over the phone. There's very little that's done through the postal system in terms of paying bills anymore. And what our clients face when they're incarcerated is that they can have one initial phone call, but the phone call after their arrest within the first 24 hours, that phone call that they're going to make is going to have to be a collect call. So somebody's going to have to accept charges from the system. Also, you cannot call through the jail phone system cell phones. And so there's many of us who don't have landlines anymore. We only have cell phones. So you're not going to be able to access that. Nobody from a financial institution or your landlord is going to accept a call from you from the jail. So you're going to be left with trying to get a hold of a family member and then possibly having to have them sign over some legal paperwork so that they can access your finances. But the reality is that most of our clients tell us if they're locked up for 30 days, it's all over with. They're going to be evicted. All their belongings are going to be out on the street, and they're going to lose their job. And you can many times a client will just say to me, I just give up. I'm 30 days in jail. It's everything's gone. I'm starting from scratch all over again.
Everything's gone. So in addition, we've talked in this series about how jobs are so affected by an experience in jail or prison, but you're saying their physical holdings are gone. Tell me an example.
Okay, so one example, an attorney that I supervised had a case where the client recognized quickly she was charged with a felony. It was a first degree assault. Ultimately, she was exonerated of the charge. She was found not guilty. But working through the circuit court system, we knew it was going to take at least 6 months to a year before she was going to be able to have a trial on that case. She recognized very quickly that she was going to be evicted from her apartment. There was nobody who was going to be able to pay the rent. But the attorney had a great deal of compassion for her because inside that apartment were the ashes of a baby that had passed away shortly after its birth. And that was her most important possession in the world. And she could recognize that she could lose her furniture and her clothing and all of her housewares, but she could not stand the thought of her child being put out on the street and that she would never be able to have possession of the urn again. So we were able to work with the landlord, go into the apartment, remove it, and store it for her so that she could pick it up after she was released from incarceration. But still going into that apartment and recognizing everything that somebody builds up over a lifetime and her reconciling to herself, I'm going to lose all of that, but there's just one thing that I can't lose. That's a very sobering situation.
When we talked to people who had been in prison, one of the big costs they brought up was child support. Paul Edwards was incarcerated from 2008 to 2010 on drug charges.
While I was incarcerated, child support was accumulating up. But I didn't get a chance to plead my side because I was incarcerated. So when my son's 5 now, I pay $606 a month. I'm in a real like $11,000 with child support, and I only make $9. So basically, my whole check is gone.
Natalie, how does child support work in prison?
Well, if an individual is serving a sentence and they have child support that is court ordered, that child support will continue until there's a court order that stalls it, puts it in abeyance. That will only happen if an individual petitions the court saying, I am now serving a sentence and I need to have my child support in abeyance. So it's very important for us when working with our clients to find out if they have court-ordered child support, and if they do, and if they're facing time in the Department of Corrections, that we assist them in getting that motion filed so that arrearage does not accrue. I don't think anybody in the system is saying that we don't think that child support should be given to children. And obviously, the children's needs continue even if a non-custodial parent is incarcerated. But it's important to remember that the vast majority of the prosecutions for failing to pay child support are done by the state for benefits that were given by the state to the custodial parent and to the child. So it isn't money that would be going directly to the child. The child is continuing to be supported by the public benefits that they receive. But this is money that the state coffers would be replenished with. And what we're saying is, if you have an individual who's serving time, we have to take a look at how realistic is it that they're going to be able to file a motion to say, hey, I'm serving time. The state should know they're serving time. And there should be a little bit of coordination amongst the agencies for this to make this an automatic process rather than something that's reliant upon somebody getting that paperwork in.
That's Natalie Finniger, Deputy District Public Defender for Baltimore City, here on The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about debts that build during incarceration. I mean, some people may be thinking, you know, these are people who broke the law. Why should we, they committed crimes. Why should we as taxpayers make accommodations for them?
Yeah, I can see that argument. And I think that people have a sense that payment needs to be made. Position is this. When somebody is encountering the criminal justice system, first of all, they're presumed to be not guilty. And over a third of the cases in the district court of Baltimore City are dismissed. And so an individual that's facing bail, facing the prospect of losing their job and their housing before they even get to their trial date is very alarming to me. So that's one part of the situation. But then even individuals that come to court and a judge makes a decision that say they should be placed on probation, and this is somebody who needs anger management or they need drug treatment or they have a mental illness and they were off their medication and that led directly to their involvement in the criminal justice system. So the judge will make a determination that that person should go and get treatment. So to better themselves and also to protect us as a society. We don't want to set up barriers from that happening. And so we need to make those options actually accessible. And when you're talking about individuals having co-pays or having to pay fees or fines, that is all putting roadblocks in the way of what we wanted to achieve in that sense. So even if an individual should be paying back to society, we need to make it realistic. We need to not spend more money than we gather back in trying to collect those fees. And we also need to be protecting ourselves in the future by helping that person get back on their feet.
Is there a way to make money while you're in jail?
Well, there is some very small work programs that exist. I think an excellent example is one at the Montgomery County Detention Center. It's been operating, I think, since the 1960s. And they actually have services where they will help people connect to employment. And they can pay for their own incarceration while they're serving a sentence that's 12 months or less, or they're within 12 months of their incarceration. So if we were able to concentrate some of our resources and making sure individuals, even if they were incarcerated for a short sentence, could get a job, had a job, paid federal and state taxes, and then also were contributing towards their own incarceration and were being monitored, and when they were released, that job is likely to still be available to them, we would be in a completely different world in terms of our situation in Baltimore. And I think that those kind of model programs out there, combined with looking at who gets incarcerated to begin with, would be a wiser use of our money.
From your work as a public defender, what is the impact of the debts that accrue to somebody who's serving time? What is the impact on recidivism?
I hear clients say, there's no way I'm going to make it. What's the point? How can I even begin to try to dig myself out of it? If I get a job, all that paycheck's going here and there. Parole and probation is collecting fees, and they have a surcharge on top of that. How am I going to get out of this? There's a certain sense of hopelessness that kind of drives people to not work within the system and kind of work in other ways. And folks that are determined to make it are going to go out and do, you know, rake leaves and mow the grass and try to work under the table. But other folks are probably going to be driven back into making money in ways that we're not interested in them doing it.
How differently does this system that we've been talking about play out for people who first encounter the criminal justice system with some money, as opposed to people who are indigent?
Well, I think there's a huge disparity in the experience. So if I were to be incarcerated and there were a $2,500 bail, I could call my husband. My husband could then go to the bank, take out some money, pay the bail. While we would have to not have that $2,500 while the case was pending, ultimately we could count on it getting back as long as I showed up for court.
Because we know you're innocent.
Right. Or even if I wasn't innocent, right? If I showed up for court, I'm going to get that money back. If I were to be ordered to do community service, there's a $5 sliding scale fee for that to begin with. Well, that's not something that's a huge hurdle for me. But if you're homeless and you panhandle and go to shelters for your meals, $5 is an impossible barrier. So if I were offered, let's say, a diversionary experience where I could pay $5 and do 20 hours of community service, I can jump on that. I can do that. But many of my clients have to say, $5, when do I have to have it by? Do I have to have it before I can sign up? Because if I do, I don't have it. Oh, I can have it towards the end of the case. Okay, I will try to ask somebody to lend me that money. And when I'm looking at $5 stopping somebody from get their case being processed the way that mine could be processed if I were in the same shoes, you have to kind of wonder about the foundation of the system and whether or not it really makes sense.
I'm really grateful to you for talking to us about it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Natalie Finniger is Deputy District Public Defender for Baltimore City. We have more information on our website, wypr.org, including links to a report by the Brennan Center for Justice titled Criminal Justice Debt, a Toolkit for Action, and a Pew Center report, Collateral Costs, Incarceration's Effect on Economic Mobility. This is The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We want to leave you with the hopes of two of the men Stephanie Hughes talked to. Despite owing big debts, they have big dreams. Here's Paul Edwards, followed by Jesse Johnson.
I actually have a six-month plan. I'm about to start truck driving school. It's 4 months for truck driving school. Hopefully in 6 months I'll be working for a company that of my choice. That's always been my big goal in life, to start a trucking company. I love driving. I love cars, trucks. I love anything dealing with auto mechanics. I love it, period. So that's really my big goal in life.
Do you have a possible name for the trucking company?
Well, I say K&P because my son's name is Caden. His middle name is Paul, but, you know, my name is Paul. So I say K&P Trucking Company. You know, that's what I always told him. You know?
I give myself my bachelor's degree, definitely. And maybe running a football team. And on my way to getting me a building. I want to get a building and open up like a youth center. And I want to have it where like children, troubled teens can come and have good mentors, guys who didn't had the experience with prison and help them to stay out of prison. Pregnant teenage girls, parents may have kicked them out on the street. They have nowhere to go, you know, all just anything that can just help kids, because I came from a rough one, so I know what it's like. And I just want to give back, you know. I stood outside on corners for a couple years of my life, maybe 10 years of my life, and I took a lot of children's parents away from them. I really think that's my way of giving back to them children. It might not be the same children, but that's how I'm viewing them. Y'all are the children that I destroyed your household, so my goal is to give back to y'all. You have a shelter where you can come and be a child and live and learn and grow up and be a successful adult like I plan to be.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, the Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to the Lines Between Us. Earlier this hour, we heard about debts that can accrue once you've been caught up in the criminal justice system. Now, how your own personal debts can land you in jail. In Maryland, if a debt collector comes after you in court, you'll receive an order to appear and talk about any money or assets that might be garnished to help pay your debt. If you don't show up, you can be held in contempt and you'll get another order to appear. If you don't come in that time, the court can issue what's called a body attachment, as in the sheriff's department can show up and take you in. And if the judge sets a bond you can't pay, well, you could end up in jail. People have to pay their debts, but has this process been happening in a way that punishes the poor for being poor? This spring, the state legislature passed a bill that could make it harder to imprison debtors. The Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition supported that bill. Executive Director Marceline White joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us on the phone is Peter Holland. He teaches a consumer protection clinic as a visiting assistant professor at the University of Maryland's Law School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Marceline, let me start with you. The prospect of incarceration doesn't even arise until a debtor has missed two court orders to appear in court. So who are these debtors, and why are they missing their court dates?
Great questions. Well, first of all, the debtors can be anyone who may have a debt that they owe, and I think it's an alleged debt that they owe under $5,000. And they oftentimes don't go to the court for a couple reasons. One, they may not have received the summons. One of the things we found is that a lot of times they rely on process servers to give you your order to appear, and people didn't even receive the notice. Other times, they don't recognize the debt. So if you had a debt from a retail card, like a Macy's card, for example, this debt is sold from your bank to a third-party debt collector, and you may hear from Joe Smith's debt collection, and you may not recognize that as your own debt. And often the debt has grown because of fees and penalties, so they may not even recognize the amount owed.
So, Peter Holland, the consumers that you work with through the clinic, what do they tell you about this process? I mean, do they even understand what these court orders mean?
Well, the answer is oftentimes no. And I'd ask your listeners, who among us, you know, knows what a quote, show cause order is? Who knows what a, quote, body attachment is? This is the kind of arcane language that is used in these things that can result in arrest and imprisonment if the bond isn't paid. I think it's really important to note up front that we're not talking about people who are in the legal system in the traditional sense we think of. I've done a study at University of Maryland. I've found that among these cases involving the debt purchasers, which Marceline described, 99% of the people do not have a lawyer. 99%. Further, the vast majority of judgments that are entered long before, you know, an arrest warrant is issued, they're done by default. So the people, for whatever reason, didn't even ever appear in court. Maybe they had fraudulent service, they were never served. Maybe they had to work the day that their court case came. And the problem with letting people ultimately be arrested on these cases, one of the problems is the whole process was informal, you know, it's small, so it's not super important to do things like due process and rules of evidence. We don't talk about that as much. And yet, if you don't pay it, you get the ultimate sanction, right? Deprivation of your liberty.
And is this an action of last resort? I mean, are there certain kinds of creditors who most often take these cases to court, or does everybody just do this across the board?
No, not everybody asks for these arrest warrants. Some, you know, ethical creditors say, we're just not going to do that in this kind of case. In fact, most of them, they say, we're not going to ask to have someone arrested over an $800 judgment. And I think you raise an important point, and that is, this is really the problem with these contempt orders. They're really being used as a creditor's remedy, right? The sin, the transgression is you didn't obey a court order to appear. But guess what? The judges, they're generally not saying, well, they didn't show, I'm going to now, you know, send the sheriff out to bring them in. No, what happens is the creditor comes forward and they say, well, judge, we would like to request this body attachment.
And I think that's an important point, is that really this is being driven by the debt collectors, not necessarily by the judges, but the judges acting and aiding the debt collector with a very informal process in terms of the court.
We talked to David Hoskins. He's an attorney in Baltimore who works in consumer law, and he thinks that part of the problem is the forms that the courts use to order appearances.
It's very confusing to anyone who gets this form as to whether or not they've actually been ordered to do anything. Because when you get the form, the first thing you see is that it's a request for an order. And it's not unless you go all the way to the bottom that you recognize that the top is a request and the bottom is where the court has ordered you to appear. And it's self-carboning, and so you submit this form, and the top one has got some pretty good writing on it, but by the time you get down to the bottom, it depends on how hard you pressed on the form.
I mean, Marceline, that's just silly. I mean, why not just fix the forms, tighten up the process by which people are ordered to appear?
Sure. I think that's a good idea, and there are lots of things that need to happen, but we've done this kind of work around foreclosures and foreclosure notices, and it took several years to get the form right to let people know that they needed help with foreclosures if their mortgage was behind. What we found is oftentimes the banks or other people will fight to keep the legalese in because it is confusing, and that way they can move forward with the judgment rather than being clear.
Marceline White is the executive director of the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition. Peter Holland is with us on the phone. He's a visiting assistant professor at the University of Maryland's Law School. On 88.1, you're listening to The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. Peter, the new law says that the debtor must be brought in front of the court or an officer of the court immediately, and that the judicial officer must impose the least onerous condition. That's the wording in the law. The least onerous condition to ensure that the debtor finally appears. So practically speaking, how will this change things? What was so onerous before, and what are the less onerous options?
Well, what's onerous before and what I see today when I go in courts and observe these dockets is that the judges, the order is requested, the judge says, okay, we'll do that, and then oftentimes the judges who are issuing these will say, I'm going to set bond in the amount of, you know, $300 or $400 or $500. And then when that's paid, they just turn that money over to the creditor. So the message is, you know, the creditor, you ought to ask for this because it's a way to get paid. Because when they pay the bond, you know, we're just going to turn it over to you. And so I think what really needs to happen, this legislation's good, but it's always discretionary on the part of a judge whether to do that or not. And really, I think judges should simply stop using this mechanism in small claims cases. And if they are going to use it, they should stop transferring the money to the creditor when the person ultimately complies. That would send the message to the creditors that this is really not going to work anymore.
So if you take away or even just weaken the ability to physically compel somebody to appear, I mean, what's left for creditors? What's the remedy here if you're a creditor? I mean, are there methods outside the court that you believe would be as effective in figuring out what assets a debtor may have and a sort of payment schedule? Marceline, what do you think?
Sure. I know that there are other ways that debt collectors can get this information. And we aren't even saying that you shouldn't go and answer those questions at some points, but there are ways they can do it using computers, using other databases, using other kinds of investigatory tools. They can get that information anyway. I think the problem with the system as it happened in the past is that the only people who were jailed were those who were not able to make their bond.
Peter, do people think about the option of declaring bankruptcy?
Well, I mean, people do, and most of the people I see, you know, the first thing they do is, you know, they talk about, well, can I declare bankruptcy? You know, long before in the process when they're first being sued. Well, bankruptcy, you know, might be right for some people, but why should someone declare bankruptcy and deprive all of the legitimate creditors of their funds if there are some that are seeking dubious things? And again, that's part of the problem, is that our small claims courts have become, for some plaintiffs, almost this assembly line thing where they're filing floods and floods of lawsuits against people, 99% of whom are not going to have a lawyer, and they're just seeking for, you know, a default judgment.
You know, people throw around the term debtor's prison when we're talking about this kind of thing. That's, of course, not prohibited, or prohibited, rather, by the Maryland Constitution. But in the original version of this bill, it would have banned the practice of arresting people for failing to appear in these debt cases. A few people opposed that. This is Delegate Louise Simmons. He's a Democrat from Montgomery County.
Very often, you know, the sheriff is scouring the county, sometimes for months, sometimes even for years, before they actually find someone and they attach them and bring them before a commissioner. You know, at a bond hearing, the sheriff may show up and may say, you know, we've been looking for this guy for 9 months.
Now, if the judge sets the bond at the amount that the debtor owes, do you think that this new law, Marceline, is going to change the thinking about that, the culture around setting the bond limits? Are they going to change?
I don't know if the new law will do that. As Peter said, a lot of times that amount will go directly to the debt collector, which is challenging as well, because oftentimes it wasn't the individual's money who was in debt. It was their parents or their relatives. They scraped together the money, and then these other people's money are going to pay off someone else's debt. What this law will do, and which I think is important, is that they have to prove the least onerous condition. So it's much harder to prove that the least onerous thing you can do is jail someone. So we think it will make a real dent in those who were arrested and stayed overnight.
All right. So as we've said before, you know, the final step here is, after two failures to appear in court, the court issues a body attachment. It's a bench warrant. And so, Marceline, you've done some research on this. And according to your numbers, in fiscal year 2012, in Baltimore County, they arrested 778 people, many more than other jurisdictions. The closest one was the city of Baltimore at 222. So one of those city residents ended up in jail. But in Baltimore County, 27 people were jailed, and one of them was in jail for 2 weeks. Do either of you know why the rates are so much higher in Baltimore County than anywhere else? Peter, what do you think?
I think that it points to the problem of, this is discretionary on the part of individual judges whether to do this or not. And we're talking about a problem that really is generated. It's a small minority of creditors, lawyers asking for these things, and a small minority of judges who are granting them. I spoke to one judge. He said he was on the bench in Baltimore City for 10 years, and he never issued a single body attachment.
That's, unfortunately, all the time we have this morning. I appreciate both of you guys coming by. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Holland is a visiting assistant professor at the University of Maryland's Law School. Marceline White is the executive director of the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition. We reached out to the Maryland Bankers Association for a comment to hear the perspective of creditors. Their president, Kathleen Murphy, was away this week. We made several attempts to get a comment from the Maryland D.C. Creditors Bar Association. They have not yet responded. Yesterday, a spokesperson for the district courts said that they'd get back to us after we asked why Baltimore County's arrest and imprisonment numbers were so much higher than in other jurisdictions, and how the new law changes things for their judges. When they do get back to us, we'll get their responses on our website, linesbetweenus.org. That's it for this week's episode of The Lines Between Us. Last week, we talked to the head of the Baltimore Police Community Partnership Unit, Lieutenant Melvin Russell. He'll be part of an event on Tuesday called For the Good of the City. It's a, quote, engagement and action summit. And former Lines Between Us guest Antero Pietola will be there. He's the author of a book about redlining called Not in My Neighborhood. Police Commissioner Anthony Batts will be there, too. It's free, but you have to pre-register. We'll have information about that at linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.